Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome, everyone. I think you're in for a very lively conversation tonight. I'm Mary Walsh, I'm the Dean of the Extension Program, and we sponsor the telemedicine and public lecture series, and we love getting new authors. The book is out today, so be sure to buy it as you go out the door. Yes, a few have already picked it up. I'm really delighted that we're going to have a conversation as opposed to a lecture. Our experience is that's always much more enlightening, and we'll include the audience as we move forward. And we're going to have it with two of the smartest men I know. Peter Cowie, who all of you know here at UCSD, and I think many of you also know James Fallows. Peter is the Dean of the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies and the Qualcomm Professor of Communications and Technology Policy here at UC San Diego. He served as an advisor on trade policy in the Obama administration, and in the 1990s, he helped President Clinton forge a major agreement on telecommunications services with the World Trade Organization. Peter is now part of a binational group appointed by the U.S. and Chinese governments on innovation policy. And he also, here in San Diego, serves as the chairman of Connect's Innovation Institute. Jim Fallows is a longtime friend of this university and has many colleagues on our faculty here. He is the national correspondent for The Atlantic and author of the released today, China Airborne, Aviation in the Future of China. Fallows has written for The Atlantic since the late 1970s and spent some of that time reporting from Shanghai and Beijing. He is also, I just learned, an instrument-rated pilot, ergo the book. So given his strong interest in China, technology, and aviation, I'm sure this book was a pleasure for him to write, and I have a feeling it's going to be a pleasure for us to listen to him talk about it. Take it away, Peter.
Well, thanks very much, Mary, and thanks to Extension for organizing this into the Helen Edison Lecture Series. I have to say that when I heard Mary's introduction saying that two of the smartest men she knew were going to be up here, I thought she was counting Jim twice, because he is truly the preeminent journalist of our generation, charting the transformation of Asia, as well as one of the leading journalists thinking about the transformation of technology markets in the world. And Jim, in looking and reading the book carefully, I noticed that it captured two aspects of your career exactly precisely, this transformation of Asia and the workings of modern technology markets, especially aviation. In the book, you tell of your flight inside China as a co-pilot of a new Cirrus general aircraft, and it's headed to Zhuhai for an air show. And like the best of journalism, you use this tale to illustrate larger dynamics about China's gold rush economy and the challenge to China of transforming itself to match this gold rush economy's success. So I wonder if we could just start with your telling about this perilous venture.
Thank you very much, Peter. And before to build up suspense for this tale, let me say first what a pleasure it is to be here with you. Peter is such an authority on technology, on international relations, on America's dealings with China and the rest of the world, that there's nobody both more intimidating and, from my point of view, and more beneficial to have read this book and discuss it. Also, to be part of the IRPS and UCSD aura here is I feel just great. My magazine, The Atlantic, has had a number of cooperative relationships with UCSD over the years. I hope we'll have more. I've been here a number of times, so thank you. This flight, one more word of buildup. I'm just trying to let the suspense mount.
I think I'm supposed to show the book again, Jim.
Maybe I can just speak like this for the rest of the time. China is such a fascinating, complex, and contradictory place that my sense is that you need a multi-track way to understand it. You need some overviews of saying, here's the big picture on technology or the environment or whatever, and also some micro views saying, here is something where you can see the entirety of China in one image. And because I had unusual exposure to the aviation world in China, I thought this was a way and where all the big themes come together. My introduction was in almost 6 years ago, in the fall of 2006, I was in China visiting a friend whose ambition was to sell airplanes, small airplanes, to the newly rich business people of China. They couldn't fly them in the Chinese airspace, but they could buy them and park them outside their houses, and people could say, wow, you know, that's an airplane. And so the way to show this off was at the Zhuhai Air Show. Zhuhai, down near Hong Kong, has an airport about as big as the one at LAX and about one flight per day. The airport was built as a real estate venture by the local people, and they don't get that many flights, but it was a great real estate deal. But every 2 years, there's a huge international exhibition there. And my friend, the salesman, had to get his airplane to Zhuhai so he could sell it to some of these people. So I was improbably the most experienced pilot of this kind of airplane in China. That said something about the level of aviation skills there. But the short version of our trip was we had three episodes that you would try to avoid in a normal modern aviation society. First, we didn't have any gas for this airplane. So we had to finally, they were trying to get some from across the provincial border. Finally, there were some old Russian trainers that people siphoned the gas out, you know, into barrels, then drove their barrels across the tarmac to our plane, and again, siphoning it with hoses into the airplane's wings. So this was not normal aviation practice. But we figured if we ran the engine up enough times, we'd see if the gas would work at all. Second, as we were about halfway through the trip on an instrument plan, learning later on there were PLA jets circling us the whole way because it's so unusual to have foreign pilots in Chinese airspace. We were trying to talk with a controller to mention to him that there were some mountains that we were headed to. You know, we were at like 4,000 feet and the mountains were like 8,000 feet, so it was time to climb. The controller, although required to speak, he was required to speak English by international aviation law, but obviously he'd never had foreign pilots there before. My friend, who was the salesman, was perfectly fluent in Chinese, but he didn't want to speak Chinese because he thought it would be against protocol to do that. So we were kept more and more nervously saying, you know, permission to climb. Finally, a Japan Airlines pilot, who was fluent in Japanese, obviously, but also Chinese and English, heard our more and more plaintive cries and relayed to the controller saying, you know, let these people climb. The controller was used to dealing with airline pilots, so finally said, oh, yes, you know, you can do it. So then we got there, we got over the mountains, and we're coming into the approach to this Zhuhai Airport, which is a great big runway, but it's in the middle of Hong Kong Harbor with all the peaks, and it was a low overcast we're going into. And as we were about maybe a 1,000 feet above the ground, the instrument landing switch turned off. You know, the signal turned off. Any of you who are pilots would know this is not a good thing because the thing which is guiding you down through the clouds suddenly wasn't there. So we had 2 or 3 seconds of real panic and deciding, are we going to do a go-around, which we're just prepared to do? And then suddenly we saw the runway. We landed. We got down. So next day, the Zhuhai Air Show, millions of airplanes there. But it was an introduction to both the ambitions and the imperfections, the Chinese technology landscape. And I survived.
So the book really weaves back and forth between the particulars of the aviation industry's transformation and challenges and the larger story of Chinese society. And early in the book, there's a passage that really struck me. You know, in this audience, which is knowledgeable about China, I suspect if we began asking people what would be the way of comparing in a thumbnail China and the United States, they'd say something like, well, the United States is about a democratic capitalist system. China is about a communist mixed economy system. But your take was a little bit different. You described China as an assemblage of organizations, aspects, and subcultures. And you say it is a living set of contradictions. So could you explain to us how and in what ways you mean that China, an ancient civilization state, is actually in some ways less organized and unified than the United States?
Yes, and thank you. This was One of the main challenges in my time over the last 6 years, mainly in China for The Atlantic, was conveying both the excitement of being in China, which those of you who have spent time there know, just every day, every hour, there's something new, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but just intense. So to convey that, and also the sense of how varied, different, surprising, and contradictory it could be with the image of most people in the U.S. that was a great big centralized state. In fact, it's a great big decentralized chaos that sometimes can do some things by central order, but there's limited capacity for that. And so for example, so I meant at one level the idea that I'm sure many of you recognize that anything you say about China is true somewhere. That it's good and it's bad, and it's controlled and it's uncontrolled, and it's rich and it's poor, and it's going forward and it's going backward. But even more, I wanted to sort of drill down on the idea of how much of the activity there was out of the hands of the central authorities. And there's one part of my saga that's very much the central authorities, which is the way the military controls all the airspace and the territory. But almost everything else is from these boosters outside Xi'an who have an idea that they're going to make some kind of aerotropolis. And it's partly a real estate deal. It's partly this idea of setting up Silicon Valley in the middle of nowhere. You're having people down in Zhuhai who think they're going to overtake Seattle as the next big aviation center. So just this accumulation of energy that's just coming up from all these people with dreams, with schemes. Can I tell the story of Mr. Xu and the fishhook for a moment?
Please,
so there's a guy named, his family name is Xu, X-U. I think Chen Dong is his personal name. He left Shanghai with no money. He came to the U.S. in 90 or 91 after the Tiananmen problems. He had so little cash when he arrived in the U.S. that the taxi ride from JFK to his college dorm used up almost all his money. So he had to get a job that night. He got another job the next day. He was a student at the same time. He got rich over the next 20 years, came back to China. What he remembered in the U.S. was he was on a fishing trip in Long Island Sound. The people were casting their lines out, and on one back cast, a great big grappling hook went into somebody's eye. And so everybody was terrified and panicked and all that. And the captain calmly said, "Do not worry. In less than 8 minutes, the Coast Guard will be here." And so a Coast Guard helicopter at 7 minutes, 45 seconds came down, rescued this guy. His eye was okay. His life was saved and everything. And Mr. Xu said, "From that day onward, my dream was to have helicopters for China. You know, in my country, this man would have died. He would have lost his eye. His family would be destroyed." So now he's back in Inner Mongolia making helicopters. And so they're just, you know, you extrapolate that by thousands of people. And that's the kind of thing I mean, just sort of the surging, uncoordinated activity.
You also make some telling points, though, about the issues of scale. The land mass of the U.S. and China is roughly comparable, but the population is about four times larger. Could you talk a little about that?
Yes. I mean, we all know that as a generality. Here is a way that a guy named Thomas Barnett, who you probably know, a military strategist, used this comparison, which struck me as having vividness that really makes it come alive. So China's landmass is about the same as continental the U.S. The arable landmass is approximately the Mississippi eastward. You know, the rest is desert and mountains and a forbidding territory. So in the Mississippi eastward, you have the population of the U.S. and the population of Canada, the population of Brazil, population of Mexico. In fact, the population of the entire Americas in that same one-third of the U.S., plus Nigeria, plus Japan. You know, all those people, and I think about with that range of richness and poorness and educational level in the Mississippi eastward. And you can see the force of numbers, why there's such scarcity as the motif. And also one other thing, which I'm sure you know, but I've tried to convey, that I think most people in China spend no time in their day thinking about overtaking the United States. They're thinking about getting through the next day and getting, you know, an apartment for their kid and all that sort of thing.
So there is a tradition of centralized control, and you captured it partly in the discussion of the military. I wanted to explore that a little bit more because it's true that the military is both a powerful institution, but it has some perverse implications for the economy, as you relate here. And I wonder if you could sort of spell those out.
Yes, and for understandable reasons, I was able to penetrate less deeply into the PLA structure than some other parts of Chinese society, but its shadow is over a lot of the economy. Partly, as many of you know, the PLA is both required to be and tolerated to be a business organization. Required to be because early on it was supposed to cover its own costs. This was an extension of Mao's dictum of the PLA, military not being a drag on society. But now there are hotels and there are casinos and there are pirate video stores and all these things run by the PLA. Many, many, many retired PLA officers have roles as big shots, sometimes crony capitalists. In this particular business in almost any kind of high-tech business, there is a nervously policed frontier between the PLA and technology ambitions. It's particularly important in aerospace, partly because the military, of course, has a role in aerospace, but also the military owns all the air in China. And so if you want to have air routes that are more direct between Shanghai and, in Beijing or Tianjin or whatever, and if you want to have a business jet industry, the main thing between you and success there is the PLA, because the PLA controls the air rights. And so a fascinating battle is underway between the aspiring business interests in China who want to make helicopters, they want to sell helicopters, they want to buy helicopters and business jets and Cessnas and Gulfstreams. They're building 100 airports. So the PLA would rather not give them any of the airspace, and they want to have it. So in the small scale, you see red envelopes with money going to local PLA colonels if you want to have permission to land a plane, or some PLA officials saying, gee, I wish I could help you with your airspace concerns, but my computer is so backward. How could I do these things with such a bad computer? If only I had a better computer, I might be able to pay attention to your needs. And then at the grand scale.
Faculty says this to me all the time, by the way.
They have a future in uniform, I guess. So that is a real battle where foreigners, including the U.S., are trying to be midwives and referees of these battles, of having the security interest give up control. And I try to present that as a model for one of the bigger choices for China in general, the security state versus the commercial state.
This tension between the military as a functional organization, leaving aside the commercial dimension of the PLA, and the civilian side of the economy is one that's common, in fact, to any sophisticated country and economy. In the United States, for example, the military actually controls well over 50% of the radio spectrum, and yet we have these worries that we don't have enough radio spectrum for broadband mobile services, right? And in the United States, there is an elaborate division of labor and structure within the White House to try to have a mediation between that military set of resources and civilian needs. The picture you paint in China is a little different, particularly when we think about the protagonist in terms of the control of civilian aviation in China and how it's evolved. As a matter of fact, it's a stunningly different picture than in the United States. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little.
Yes, and thank you for raising it, because it actually is to me a really interesting implication for China in general and this particular scene. If you're thinking about the military institutionally in China compared with Western militaries, it's striking how little it is integrated with civilian control structures at any place. Maybe somebody here can correct me, because I know there are experts on this in the audience, but my understanding is really the main point where the military command structure and the civilian command structure come together is in the person of the president, who is also the chairman of the military commission. And you don't have all those many, many layers of interleaving connection that are so distinctive in the U.S. and most Western models. And that's, again, one reason why the transition of power in China takes some number of months, because there's the job of being president, the job of being head of the Communist Party structure, and then the job of being chairman of the military commission. So that is a challenge for China, I think, internally. In how the military is going to evolve to serve the nation's needs. It's, I think, something that's been underappreciated the U.S. has done is to try to play a role with this military structure of solving a problem outside that China has for itself. The U.S. Navy in particular has been so aggressive in these military-to-military exchanges with the PLA, trying to find that way to make the PLA be part of larger structures. And as I say, in the aviation world in particular, The FAA and Boeing have, in a completely unpublicized way, essentially run the Chinese aerospace system and made it safe over the last 15 years, as opposed to being so dangerous.
Right. The other legacy of these ancient imperial systems, it seems to me, is often that the few instruments of control that the center had tended to be quite consolidated and omnivorous in a way. And that seemed to be the story of the Civilian Aviation Agency in China. I have to say that even I was surprised a little by the extent of it. And maybe you can talk a little about that.
Yes, there is. The histories of aerospace in China and the United States could not be more different, where you have in the United States all this ferment of different activities. Of course, the Wright brothers and their contemporaries got things started. The military was an important initial customer for them, but there were civilian industries, there were individual hobbyists, there was this huge diversity of activity. In China, this was a military-only activity from the get-go. The main aerospace factories were placed in Xi'an by Chairman Mao, mainly because that was the place in China farthest from the nearest foreign border, so hardest to bomb. So if you had it in the coast, it could be bombed, and Xi'an was protected, and the airspace was all controlled by the military. And until, say, 15 years ago, the CAAC, the Civilian Aviation, I forget the actual acronym, but the CAAC simultaneously made the airplanes, ran the airlines, sold the tickets, trained the pilots, ran the safety inspections, did all the other things, which in Western models had checks and balances applied and competitive pressures. Among the problems for that was the terrible safety record of Chinese airlines until about 20 years ago. Many of you flew the airlines in those days. You all, by definition, survived, but you know that many people didn't. You know, they were very, very dangerous, in part because in Western aviation, there's a really elaborate check and balance system of check airmen. As a pilot, you have to, your license is good for life, but your rights to exercise it are subject to continual refreshing, you know, biennial flight reviews, night flight, instrument proficiency, and all the rest. That was not the case in this monolithic control model. So, in a wonderful moment where a China Southern flight got its first permission to land at LAX. They were all excited. They landed at LAX, and the plane was immediately impounded with like 100 safety violations by the FAA. So China Southern was upset. They called Boeing and said, we can't buy any more of your planes if we can't fly them to America. So Boeing arranged essentially to have the FAA go to China and say, here's how you do check flights for pilots. Here's how you do a separate board. Here's how you do simulator training. And over the last 10 or 15 years, it's had a miraculous effect of a change in governance that wasn't possible for China to do itself.
Right. I think this is a very interesting, deeper point that you're making, which is that in the United States, we often complain about the fragmentation of governance and the way in which you can't get the feds and the state and the local people to agree on anything, and therefore it's a complex environment. But it's also a constitutional environment where they're expected to work it out in some way, even if imperfectly, and it does produce that system of decentralized authority and checks and balances, as you say. Whereas in China, this requires a very extraordinary piece of engineering to get this.
Yes, and I think it is to the credit both of the Chinese side that they had an appetite for this and of the U.S. side, including a lot of individuals who just decided that their life's work had previously been in Seattle or in Chicago, but for the rest of their lives, they're going to live in Tianjin or in Beijing or in some little burg and try to train people about how you ran this sort of governance system. So for all of the contentions of the U.S.-China relationship, it is amazing if you just look, if you take the lid off, you see all these fascinating, it's like opening up a watch and seeing all these connections you didn't know were there before.
When you talk about this sort of transnational mutual assistance, you made much of your early career in Asia observing Japan during its rise and its shining moments on the global stage. Could you imagine the same thing with Japan in that era?
I will ask you this question when I finish my answer, because this is one of your areas of great expertise. I was continually struck by the small similarities and the enormous differences between the Japanese and Chinese paths towards development. The similarities are character-based writing system, East Asian, some shared culture over the years, and a developmental model, as UCSD's own wonderful Chalmers Johnson had explained over the years. But, of course, the difference was Japan, after World War II, had been a rich country before. China is a poor country struggling very quickly to catch up. So my impression, my argument when living in Japan during the late 80s was that this was more of a problem for the United States than I think China actually is, because these large, already rich, sophisticated Japanese corporations were able to compete head-to-head with their U.S. And there's nobody to compete head-to-head in China now. So, you know, there's no Toshiba, there's no Sony, there's no Toyota in China at the moment. So I think that it's... And one other point, agree or disagree from the crowd or from you, I find China a much more permeable and accessible place than Japan. Its very fragmentation and scale means there are 1,000 access points as opposed to one big system that has its own sense of itself and harder. Agree or disagree?
Well, I think I would agree, because although we sometimes underplay the amount of regional rivalry inside of Japan, it nonetheless was a much more cohesive hierarchical structure for advancement
right.
than anything that you show in the book about China. And so I think that permeability is there. Let me turn from aviation more directly to the second big theme of your book about economic growth in China. And since the financial crisis in 2008, I think that the predominant storyline in the American press has been China has an alternative model of growth. It's hugely successful. Its export economy shows its strength. This represents a great crisis for American leadership in the world. And therefore, we need to take careful parsing of the Chinese model to see if it's going to overtake the United States. Your book really lays out in some vivid detail what many of our friends in China who are economists talk about, and my colleagues like Barry Naughton have laid out in their work, which is this fear in China that there is an imminent moment of a lower middle income trap. And a lower middle income trap is a fancy way that economists talk about the idea that at this point China has risen with the growth that is induced by the movement from the countryside, which is low productivity, to the urban centers, which is high productivity, therefore wealth creating. And with it, it is based on an export-based manufacturing assembling system. And it's trying to add value to it. And it's worried that the demographics of a cheap labor force is disappearing, that the pressures of cost structures as they move up the value chain will limit their competitiveness. And so that this golden moment they're living in may stop with them being not the next United States, but maybe the next slightly poorer Mexico as a model. So can you talk a little in the book about what you see as the pros and cons of these fears in China?
And you're right that is exactly the question I was trying to address in this book of how far can China go, using these ambitions as a microcosm for problems or challenges overall. First, about the fears of China. An argument I was trying to make, and in this book and in previous writings, is that America has serious things to worry about, but they have nothing to do with China. You know, that our distribution of income is a real problem. My original home state of California, I grew up in Redlands, shows how you can have a rich private economy and a dysfunctional public sector, and whether that's extending to the nation as a whole. So we have reasons to worry about decline, but if China didn't exist, I think the same factors would be here. If it's useful to have China as a spur to improve, okay, but not as a source of things that are happening here. In my view, also, as I've tried to write a lot of times and lay out in this book, if you think we have problems, the Chinese have way worse problems than we do, and pollution and all the rest, including then we come to this potential lower middle income trap. And the way I try to pose that problem is whether the China of the future is likely to be anything more than a bigger busier version of what we see now. You know, in the last 30 years, we've seen a phenomenal alleviation of poverty. I'm going to have an article in the Sunday New York Times Week in Review section this week on exactly this point of how, you know, how to think about whether China is going to change. What it's accomplished in the last 30 years is due, as you say, to movement from the countryside, low-wage manufacturing, infrastructure, construction, and all these things, but not the high-value corporate brands that Japan had and where all the value really goes. My reliable visual aid, I have an iPad inside here. Let's say it costs $500. It's made in China. $50 go to China. The rest goes to Apple, and it goes to FedEx, and it goes to Samsung and others who make the components. I think there are challenges for China in trying to take this next step because the not for resource constraint reasons. They have, as we know, the money to throw into universities and research centers and everything else. But for all the soft culture of capitalism, soft power type factors that you see as traits of every rich country, whether it's intellectual property protection, as you are one of our great experts on, or truly independent university establishments. And here is a simple proxy for the challenges China faces. How many people here have used the internet in China? I bet most people. You know that it is really slow compared to the internet in the United States. That's not for technical reasons. They have broadband better than most of ours. It's for censorship reasons. You know, the burden of the Great Firewall really makes things slow. A slow internet is a proxy for bad universities, bad research centers, not being able to attract the world's talent there. So I think the next step will be a deeper test of China's character and system than the previous 30 years have been. Because the previous 30 years have shown, 30 years ago, there were some people who said, as China prospers, it will have to become more democratic. That was facile, because it's prospered and it's not more democratic. I think there's a genuine question of whether it can become rich without liberalizing. And that's the drama we're watching.
Right. Let me just push one other aspect of this macroeconomic story that you discussed, which is you argue that the export story of China, this enormous drive of export-led industrialization, is also a sign of its weakness. And I think it'd be useful for you to spell that out a little.
So in terms of just the small share of resources that go to its own people. So it's one of the things which is oddest about the Chinese economic model, if you view it, is that even with all the huge increase in living standards for its people, only about half of the output of the Chinese economy is consumed by the Chinese public. The rest is invested domestically, both publicly and privately, and internationally in the form of trade surpluses with the U.S. and the treasury notes they hold and the private investments and all the rest. And so a sign of a more balanced and mature economy would be the capacity within China for its people to consume more of this wealth in their own ways. And so it's a sign of imbalance and distortion and weakness in the sense of not being able to have more sophisticated products. Is that the angle you were thinking of?
Very good. The story of moving up the value chain as a national objective is captured in the book, in fact, by Aviation, which you have this striking phrase. You call it an apex product for an advanced economy. I don't know if that's because that's your exact analytic metaphor or you thought it'd be really good for a book with the title of
yes.
China Airborne.
It was, as with so many things in writing, it was the best thing I could think of at the time. You know, any book, any form of writing is the best you can do by the time you have to finish it. So that was the best I could do. And the idea here, and I thought of a new illustration too, is there's certain forms of economic success and activity which, if you can pull them off, bespeak a huge range of other accomplishments that are sort of subsets of that. Here is the biological analogy. If you go into the wetlands and you see lots of frogs and newts, you know that there is a healthy wetland ecology. So too, with these apex industries or apex products. Universities are not actually an industry in the strict sense, but to have an excellent university system requires things in terms of public funding, in the attractiveness of your environment that people want to come from around the world. The same is true, I think, pharmaceutical industries. They imply a public health system, research, et cetera. Strangely, an entertainment industry requires a kind of soft power understanding of the world. The Chinese are pouring a lot of money into movies, but people don't want to watch them. And Hollywood, for better and worse, has something that people around the world want to watch. Aerospace requires a surprisingly vast network of accomplishments and successes in civil-military relations, in quality standards, in integration of the vastest scale projects that people carry out, in sort of routinizing governance systems, both public and private, to ensure safety. So I quote a very interesting man there named Shane Tedjerati, who said, it'll be easier for China to go to the moon than to have something like Boeing, because going to the moon is like building the Three Gorges Dam and shooting it up. You know, it's a great big public project. But having a commercial aircraft industry is the most complex thing that people do. So if they could do that, that would mean a real step in maturity.
Yet there are lots of analysts in the U.S. who fear that's exactly what we're seeing. And you talk about the effort of a state-owned enterprise, COMAC, to build the Chinese challenger to Airbus and Boeing in the C919. That effort represents some of the things that, if you turn to discussions in Washington, would be commonly cited. Subsidized credit, unlimited amounts of credit, essentially. Secondly, the use of the Chinese market as a leverage point on foreign suppliers to induce technology transfers, and the willingness of government to retune the rules in China to assure that there's a path forward for Chinese aircraft. So why aren't you so worried about this?
It's a serious question, which I'll answer in sort of two stages. One is to recognize that there is, in the current 12th five-year plan, one of its key industries that China is supposed to advance in is aerospace, and there's this multi-level front there. The high end, there's the C919, which is supposed to be the ultimate Boeing or Airbus-type competitor. There's a mid-range regional jet, which is supposed to be the Embraer competitor. They now own the leading small airplane company in the world, Cirrus Design of Duluth, Minnesota, and helicopters, which are being made with a great number there. And exactly as you say, all the elements of sort of predatory industrial policy are present, especially in the big airplane and regional jet projects. And Airbus and Boeing have to do a lot of their work inside China to be able to sell to this largest Chinese market. So far, this has mainly been an illustration of the frustration of this kind of industrial policy. Number one, in that it's the content of the C919 airplane is going to be so heavily U.S., European, and Japanese that it's like an iPad. It's a disguised export model for, you know, the GE engines or Rolls Royce or Pratt and Whitney engines, Honeywell Avionics, Rockwell Collins, and all the rest. So it is an export vehicle. Also, the participants in this, notably the engine makers, GE and Pratt & Whitney, who have the crucial technology and for value in aviation, are entirely alert to the dangers you set out. They recognize that if they let their technology leak out, they are done. So I hope they're talking to you every day about how to sell there without selling out there, in a way that Intel, I think, has fairly shrewdly done. They sell in China, but they don't do their first-tier work in China. And I think that it's so far mainly been a kind of an export vehicle and a demonstration of how hard it is to integrate all these things. I think the proper U.S. approach would be to bring you into the government and insist on fairer rules on export financing and to have protections for intellectual property and all the rest. But for the foreseeable future, it looks as if it's demonstrating how difficult it is for the Chinese model to replicate this rather than how easy.
If you went over to our School of Engineering or our biology department here. But let's stay with the School of Engineering because aviation is an engineering project. There's a great deal of focus on the fact that China has enormous rosters that are growing at staggering rates of new researchers, many of them trained in world-class universities, a growing patent pool, and a broad range of laboratories with state-of-the-art equipment. And sitting in the University of California system where, you know, the Xerox machine is now state-of-the-art technology, this is a real issue. So why are you not so worried about that in terms of its ability to do an independent breakthrough in these key technologies like engines or avionics?
On the one hand, I am very worried about what the United States is doing to it, the most important part of its patrimony, its university system, notably the University of California system. And so, again, if China didn't exist, this would be a tragedy we were inflicting upon ourselves. And so I think that is a genuine emergency for us. So with that on one side, I think it is simultaneously true that so far the rapid push of money and facility and hardware and numbers into the Chinese university and research establishment has again illustrated more the limits of their model than its successes, in that if you have universities that still, number one, have trouble attracting the world's leading research talent because they don't want to live in the pollution of Beijing, they don't want to have a handicapped internet, they don't want to have visa problems, et cetera, all these things, the soft conditions of a first-rate research institution. They're also all simultaneously the conditions of Chinese academia mean that the high output of patents and research papers is not matched by breakthrough nature of these patents or research papers that are cited elsewhere. So I'm not meaning to be complacent and saying, no, this will never take off. I'm giving a different kind of reassuring answer. I'm saying that if it were to take off, that would indicate that something positive had changed in China, that a China that was more successful in these ways would be a China easier to deal with. Right. So that's why it's a reassuring message.
In these closing minutes of our conversation before we open to questions from the floor, maybe I could turn to the events of the last few weeks.
Yeah.
I was in Beijing as part of the U.S. delegation as of the Strategic and Economic Dialogue talks, and it was a bizarre bubble that we were in. The Chinese Communist paper publishes a major daily newspaper, and the headline during the middle of the Chen Guangcheng crisis dominating the front page of the paper was, China agrees to liberalize imports from Hungary, which was good news for paprika, but probably not a good sign for the ability of the Chinese system to handle this growing challenge to authority that we see creeping up. So I wonder what your thoughts were.
And so I will respond by first asking you a quick sort of journalistic question. The conventional wisdom among U.S. journalists, which I disagreed was that the U.S. delegation had completely mishandled the Chun case and they'd been snookered by the Chinese authorities. Was that your sense on scene or not?
First of all, the chief U.S. negotiator on that, Kirk Campbell, is a former student of some of us here at UCSD. I love my former students. But on top of that, I don't think that was right. And I think it shows that people don't understand that time constraint of you're trying to get closure on both sides before the secretary shows up, because this is a giant roadshow. Yeah. There are 400 U.S. officials at these talks, right, is such that you can use that as leverage. And I think that's what they were trying to do, to come to a deal. And it was a very complicated situation, as we saw. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that it was mishandled in the sense that the critics charge.
And it's interesting that tendency in the U.S. media in a way reflects something about China, by which I mean the following. that to me, the Chun case said much more about the tensions inside China than any kind of mishandling on the U.S. State Department team. But that was the latter is the only thing the U.S. press cared about. So, too, with China, it's much more interested in China than external things. I think the sequence of events, the Boshi Lai scandals over the last 6 months and the Chun case over the last month, they both illustrate exactly the issues we're talking about here, which is the challenges to the Chinese system in the anything other than the material realm. When it comes to the material realm of building things and paving land, the Chinese system has had no peer. But we're seeing various strains on its institutional governance. I think still it's the case that most people in China say the system has done more good for them than bad for them. It's working more than alternatives. But problems of transparency, of accountability, of succession, of individual liberties are serious ones. And I think not that they threaten immediate overthrow of the system, but they are part of the management that it has to carry out. It also means the gigantic budget for soft power, happy face around the rest of the world is undone in a week by one of these great episodes.
You talk in the book about the notion of a permanent emergency as a new phenomenon in China. Could you say a word about that?
Yes. I was referring to the state of civil liberties within China. My premise is there's not a huge demand for greater democratization among most Chinese people, but there is demand for more liberties, being able to travel, being able to speak, and all the rest. And over the last 6 years, when we've had a lot of sort of firsthand experience with China, there was a time early on, say 2006, 2007, where things seemed to be steadily becoming more liberal. And in the last 2 or 3 years, they seemed to be getting tighter, more and more tightly closed down. And the excuse was there was always some special reason why things were especially sensitive. It was the build-up to the Olympics. Then it was after the Olympics. Then it was the build-up to the Shanghai Expo. Then it was the twin sessions or the twin meetings. Then it was, last year, it was the Arab Spring, which was a really dramatic crackdown. You know, for a while, you couldn't use the internet at all. Then it was the transition of power. So there's always some, it's a permanent emergency. And the question for that I think is legitimate to ask is over 30 years, we've seen ups and downs, but a steadily ascending level of liberty within China. And over the last 3 years, I think we've seen a descending level of liberty within China. Query, is this a three-year just blip, or is this an actual change? And I don't know, and I hope it's the former.
In the book, you tell a wonderful story about the purchase of one of the new commuter jets, and the entrepreneur comes in with $20 million in cash and hands it over to buy the jet. And you ascribe it to the sign of a sort of rough-and-tumble frontier capitalism at work. But the Bose story might suggest that there's something else at work.
Yes.
The book's sort of sanguine about the issue of corruption in China. You say there's a lot of it, but it's manageable and it's not eroding the system. But now there are indications that maybe it's a little more pervasive than that story suggested.
Yes. And the distinction I was trying to draw, there was a distinction about this cash sale that I saw at the Hong Kong Air Show about a year and a half ago. And if you're going to have cash sales in some narco-terrorist country, you might think they're all from the narco trade. This was some guy from southern China who had a steel factory, and he made a lot of money. And so it was more of kind of the frontier ethic. But I had tried to say that compared with some societies, China had had an efficient level of corruption rather than a crippling level of corruption. But it may be that things are exceeding that, and that the Boshi Lai case does suggest that the tax on society could be more than I certainly was aware of. Certainly, if you compare China with Russia, I would argue that Russia has a more evidently crippling level of corruption than China has had. They still have gotten the business done even while creating billionaires. But it may be that there are strings we're pulling on that are leading in unexpected directions.
Well, let me just push this question of political transition one step further. We both watched the rise of Japan. We saw a political system that was very stylized. It was one-party rule with democratic elections. It was tightly intertwined among a set of leading companies, a bureaucracy that served the system, and a political leadership that was organized into family-dominated factions. That sounds a little like China in some ways. And the Japanese crisis in some ways of economic recovery was that once the economic model broke, the political system didn't have the resilience to adapt to a new economic model. It's still running through that problem today after 20-some years. Is that a risk for China?
It is, comma, but. And the way I'd put the but is I view it, Japan over the last 25 years as being a still underappreciated economic success story. You know, their market share in high-tech fields has increased, et cetera. It's still a very rich country. A financial failure story and a political disaster story. You know, the political system is completely dysfunctional in Japan. In the Chinese case, I would argue that the system so far has been better than the Japanese system at addressing the big problem of the day. You know, if you want to have a crude test for whether a political system works or not, is whether it can match the resources of the society to the main problem of the society. America's, by that measure, is not very functional right now. We have problems we could easily solve, but we can't solve them. Japan's is a failure. They can't deal with their problems at all. China's, so far, whatever is the biggest issue right now, they found some way to address. And if that stops being the case, if the internal contortions over family and regional dynasties and corruption and the role of the military mean they can't try to make the transition in some of these economic ways, they can't address the relationship with the United States, then you would have a Japanese-type situation. Here would be a test case to me. It would be a sign of real failure of Chinese politics if they let the U.S. relationship become outright confrontational, because they all recognize that would be a huge problem for them. So the fact they've been able to bring it back on keel, I think, is a sign of success there.
So let's turn to the United States for a moment at the end of this conversation. I've heard we have a presidential election coming up, and our transition in power is going to happen, looks like, about the same time as in China. The two candidates, in some ways, are in a discussion about China in a preliminary stage of the campaign that looks like it's right out of your book's closing discussions about the United States and the world. And you make the, I think, absolutely accurate point that the United States' soft power has been enhanced by the fact that our idealistic moments are about universal values. And we have difficulties because we both have practical interests to balance with that, but also we have sometimes a missionary zeal about those values that leads to quite a bit of suspicion around the world about whether those values are what we state them to be. We have two presidential candidates who are trying to balance that, in fact, universal set of values that they both support and these practical interests, and like all contenders, Romney is right now saying that the president isn't being tough enough about our ideals. So how do you see this playing out in your role as a presidential political observer and also somebody concerned about the U.S.-China relationship?
On this universalism point, to me, the best and the worst thing about America in the world is that we think everybody else wants to be American. You know, that it's the best thing about us because we think in principle any person, no matter where he or she is a potential American, and they probably want to be here. And so that is good, and also it's bad. It means we have a tin ear and we all the other things that you recognize. And China has an opposite best and worst, as we can talk about later on. A depressing aspect of the U.S. political campaign this year, you know, one of not the only depressing aspect, but a depressing aspect, is I think the discussion of America's role in the world will be completely unedifying. It's going to be on Obama's side that I killed bin Laden and we're getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan. And on Romney's side, it's going to be you're betraying Israel and you're selling out our jobs. And I think that's what the discussion is going to be. I think that if Romney were elected, I think the part of foreign policy that would differ least may be relationships with China. Mm-hmm. Because, and I say that on the basis that since the normalization under first Richard Nixon and then Jimmy Carter, for all the differences in politicians, the policy towards China has been about the same, of recognizing it's better to work with them than against them, but also we disagree in many fundamental ways. So I think if Romney, it is improbable that if somebody with Romney's business background would be the big sort of China basher. And I think he, if elected, would have the same mixture of working with China, but also standing up on certain issues of principle that Obama and their predecessors have had to.
So as a closing question, let me ask you about one key aspect of the U.S.-China relationship where there are common interests, but also tensions because of the distribution of costs and benefits and common action. That's about climate change and the environment. You identify that the environment as one of the key political challenges in China, besides the enormous cost for public health and economic growth from the environmental problem. We have on both sides a sophisticated scientific establishment that basically agrees that climate change is a big deal and that there are going to have to be major steps to deal with it. And both countries share a rejection of the prototypical global solution of the Kyoto Protocol that the European Union is the major advocate of. So as a test case of the ability of the two countries to work together pragmatically, what do you see as our chances of grappling with this?
So far, the high-level demonstration would be pretty discouraging, because at the international talks, the U.S. and China have often ended up at loggerheads. As a precedent point, I'll say I think the environmental despoilation is China's worst problem and the most serious obstacle to its continued development and success. And of course, with spillover effects for the rest of the world, it also is something they're working on very, very hard. The challenge ideologically for China is that a solution on the global level inherently is unfair to them. They say, look, you America, you England, you Germany, you polluted things when you were developing. We're still poor. Why can't we pollute too? And the answer to that is the world can't afford it. You know, it's unfair. That should be the case, but it just is the case. I think the positive aspect is that the level below the heads of state, there really is quite extensive work between the U.S. and Chinese institutions on cleaner coal, on aviation. Boeing is sponsoring a huge algae fuel project in Qingdao, you know, to try to make all Chinese jet fuel out of algae. You know, whether it work, who knows? So I think that this is yet another area where below the level of the high-end confrontation, there actually is some chance for institutional collaboration and individual. And without that, the prospects for us all are grimmer than they would otherwise be.
Well, I certainly don't want to close on a grim note. So let me ask you, if you were thinking down the line, 5 years from now, what do you think will be looked upon as the positive note in U.S.-China relations in that time?
I hope, I haven't thought of that, but I hope it will be the much larger number of actual U.S. people who have extensive firsthand experience in China. China is transformed because so many people there have experience in the U.S. I'm encouraged to see lots of young Americans in China speaking Chinese. And so if that is the experience of maturation for lots of young Americans, I think that will be enriching for them, good for America, good for China, and good for the world.
Well, as the dean of a school dedicated to the transformation of global society through the Pacific, I totally agree. And on behalf of the audience, I want to thank you, Jim, for this great conversation.
Thank you, Peter.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.